The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
I'm a great devotee of doubt. I think it's a lovely, wonderful, freeing thing to be able to hold up things and wonder about them and not just assume them. And I think that's the great, you know, if you want to grow or evolve, then the price is you have to be an idiot because you constantly look at yourself and go, oh, I was an idiot. But there's the other side. You know, I've developed this thing I call paralogical thinking, seeing an opposite. So the other side of that is, but still do your best to come up with the best understanding at any one time, knowing that it will be superseded and that there will be more. But I'm still looking for the best. I don't give up or just go, oh, well, this will do.
It's a wonderful chaos, beautifully random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem?
We work to find rest and fight to find peace, both head and the heart.
Show.
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheist pray.
It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way.
Hello and welcome to Wonderful Chaos.
Welcome to Wonderful Chaos, Andy.
As you see, we have Rani Paputri to my left today, maybe to your right, depending on how you're seeing this. Bambos Dimitriou is not well. I don't know exactly what it is, but we'll find that out. But he was so unwell that Rani was basically sitting in a room next to me. And I said, how would you like to be the co-host today?
And what did I say?
You said, I have another engagement, but I'll make concession for you. So we have Rani today. And today we are going to be with Tim Freak. I always have a hard time saying freak. It just doesn't feel right. It just feels...
Have you ever asked him how you should actually pronounce his last name?
I actually saw him say it once. Maybe it was even online that he said that's the way to say his name. Oh. And if he's not right. So we're going to have him on today on what, baby?
A Wonderful Chaos.
Yes, we will. Da-da-da. So Tim Freak. I was introduced to Tim from the same man that introduces me to several individuals, and that's Gino Yu. Mm-hmm. Polytechnic University in Hong Kong. And he throws people and says, hey, you guys should chat. And Tim and I spoke maybe nine months ago, I believe. And it was just a beautiful talk. It was like there's sometimes you pick up the phone and you feel like, oh, you're just there's a brother in the world.
Nice.
And you don't even
connection.
Yeah, just a beautiful person, right? Like there's one thing I really admire in people who have great thought and great humility. And when that balance is there, like my heart just opens because it's sort of that wisdom. The more you know, the more you know you don't know. And when you speak to someone who has given so much time and energy to their own thoughts, their own beliefs, the universal beliefs, in some ways you become there's a lot more humility. And then you kind of connect with the humility that you both feel to kind of the witnessing of the world and the wonder of it instead of trying to say, hey, I know and I understand that. So when you see me always, Ronnie and I, if you've read any of the books, you know, we're kind of different in this regard because I sit in the wonder and Ronnie likes to put a period at the end of each sentence, right? That'd be fair to say?
Yeah, that's very funny that you said so. There's one person out there who would be laughing really hard listening to what you just said, okay. Because I actually made a comment on his email. I said, wow, you're very frugal with your use of, how do you call it? The marks and the sentence, about comma and sentence and period, because he would write one sentence that can fill a paragraph.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what was your point? Because I don't understand that.
Well, because you said that I like to put points behind sentences.
yeah, you do.
So that's even literally.
Yes. So we're very different in our ways, our approaches. In fact, I think I've joked about and makes you frustrated that you haven't ever read any of the books I've written. You barely watch any of these shows. So in some ways, the fact that we are in love with one another without having to say be interested in what the other does is quite a testament to our relationship.
Actually, I just realized one thing that I do wonder and continuously wonder is you, actually, and all the things that you do.
You still don't know. That's nice.
No, but all kind of things that you suddenly come up with. And
yeah, well, that's what the wonder brings. And that's why when I'm with an individual like Tim, like there is a beauty in that wonder and sharing it with someone else and then having an hour together and not knowing where you're going to go is just a joy.
Yeah.
It's just, especially with someone it can go anywhere with. And I wrote notes about Tim because, I mean, although we get a lot of great guests on, none of our guests, as far as I know, have written 35 books. And so, like, let's start there. Like, anyone who's done 35 books has put a lot of his time and energy into thinking.
Yeah, and has a Wikipedia page.
He doesn't have a Wikipedia page. No, he doesn't. I looked. We'll talk to him. I looked for the Wikipedia. His book is in the Wikipedia, in his book, The Jesus Mysteries. And I and Ronnie, just for the record, we'll bring him on in a second. But when you knew that Tim was coming on, you said, who is the guest? And I said, he's a philosopher. And you said, wow, what is philosophy? And then you went to Wikipedia. And then you read back to me what philosophy was.
Means, yes.
And I really enjoyed you reading back. And I think if one doesn't read what the definition of philosophy is, they actually don't understand that there's this beauty of wonder in hearing it. And I'd like to just read it because I printed it out right before. Was that it's the study of general and fundamental questions about existence, knowledge, values, reason, mind, and language. And the classic philosophical questions include, is it possible to know anything? And if so, can we prove it? And that, for me, is a great segue, because when we bring Tim on, he also put up a video quite recently where he had a belief, which was quite a fundamental belief based on a lot of Eastern philosophy, which is that all of what we experience, all of what we know is through experience. And then he basically threw up everything that he's done for the last years and say, I got it all wrong. And he did a video online that he talked about that. So without further ado, we're going to bring him on, Mr. Tim Freak. And this is our first Freak Show.
Well, that was quite an intro. Thank you.
Was there anything I said that didn't connect with your own experience, or anything you'd say, oh, I correct that?
No, my name really is pronounced Freak.
Yeah.
Philosopher, I really like the root of the word philosophia, the Greek.
Yeah.
Philo means love, and Sophia means wisdom.
So a
philosopher officially is a Sophia is the name of the, you know, one of my hats has been the study of Gnostic Christianity, and Sophia is the name of the Christian goddess. So I'm a kind of professional lover of the goddess. That's how I like to see it.
It was my favorite course in school, by the way. Of all the courses I took, it was my favorite course. It was the only one. I'm still in contact with the professor today.
Uh-huh. We didn't have any philosophy at school. That was far too radical. I had to go to university to do it. It was like,
I call school university in my terminology.
You Americans, of course.
My apologies.
English language and turn it into something else.
Yeah. So thank you for coming.
The other thing I've got to pick up, just because it's fun, is it really made me laugh when you were both talking about punctuation. So my latest book, this one, Soul Story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's my best book and it's got, you know, my latest ideas. But when I wrote it, I wanted to do it in a different form. So it's written as these little sentences, a bit like some of the, you know, Nietzsche's done it and so forth, where it really follows through ideas. But it's very minimalist. And so when I came to it, I thought, why do I keep putting full stops at the end of sentences? They're not doing anything because all of the sentences are broken up. And why have I got capital letters at the beginning? So let's get rid of them. So I had to go to my publisher and say, I don't like the capital letters or full stops in the whole of the book. And you could see their face like, oh, you can't, you can't, I mean, do that. That's not allowed, you know.
That's and speaking to that, that's something that I love. And it is how we only understand this sort of internal dialogue in ourselves when conflicted with a contrast. So by not putting the periods in the, like Ronnie and I get into this argument quite regularly when I ask her to say, I'm going to read something to you. And instead of experiencing it, she sees all the incorrections and the punctuation. And I'm like, babe, just feel it. And then we'll talk about the punctuation later. She says, no, I can't even begin to think about feeling if I don't know what the punctuation is.
I have to tell you, my daughter, she's 20 now, was appalled just appalled that her dad had written a book with no full stops. I'm just like, that's unthinkable.
I think there's beautiful, because you could probably say at the end of the book, say, if you reacted in any of these five ways, this is what it says about you.
Yeah, full stop.
Beautiful. I would love to start, because I know you have, I've been trying to pronounce it and I'm really horrible, but Univisual. Okay, and I'd love to get to Univisual, but before that, I had so much fun because Ronnie and I, we went away for the weekend. We were walking in the Dutch countryside in a place called Hilversum here. Oh. And it has the biggest mountain, but I don't know exactly if we saw it or not. We're told that it has the biggest mountain.
No, that's not true.
What's not true?
It's not the mountain. Let's not besmirch.
We're not going to besmirch the Netherlands.
Yeah. Exactly somewhere I've been. So,
Hilversum, how beautiful. Yeah. And then Ronnie said, well, who's on? And then she said, well, I told him Tim is on. And she said, well, he's got this book called The Jesus Mysteries. And what I loved was, like, I saw this, because if you go to, that's where the Wikipedia is, by the way, of course, on that book, because it did create a tumultuous sort of.
It's also why I don't have a personal one anymore.
A personal way.
Anymore.
Wiki page. Yeah, I had a wiki page for pretty much the whole time Wiki's been in existence.
And it was taken down because of that book?
I think so. There was a big battle that would constantly go on between people who were trying to.
Interesting. Because that's what happens. Because they say we have to discredit the messenger. Because we don't, if we discredit the messenger, then basically the message can also be discredited.
Yeah.
Ugh. So, Bart Ehrman was not a big fan of yours, right? Because he said, CC writes sensationalist writing driven by a desire to sell books. So when I read something like that, you know, I always think to myself, there's so much of feeling of vindictiveness in it that I feel like there's not reflection in terms of what is it that he was reacting to. And what would make him state something like that? And that's just that's sort of how I feel in life in general.
Well, I'd say it was two things really. But so I have a you know, now it's 20 years ago.
Was it 20 years?
So 1999 it came out. So we're looking at it in the 90s. I have a certain sympathy with that criticism, insofar as I made a conscious choice with Peter Gandy, my dear old friend, and I've known him for years and still see him regularly. Mm. But so we did it very much together. And I really wanted not to write an academic book, but I also wanted to get it taken seriously. So what we did with The Jesus Mysteries and its follow-up, especially the two follow-ups, was to write it in an immediate style. And so when we quoted, we didn't fill it with lots of academic names. We cut that back down. And then we had copious notes. So if you wanted to check it all out, everything was noted, just about every line. So it was like a popular book within an academic book. So I think what happened with Bart from looking at his criticisms is that it was very hard for him because he didn't actually read the book. That's what was very clear. Probably he got one of his juniors to read it, someone doing a PhD with him, just put that in. And so the things where he was criticizing it were disappointing because we really wanted to engage with some of the academics, and we have with some.
The main thesis was that Jesus was a pagan god.
That's what we should get to, really, isn't it?
Isn't it? So Jesus was a pagan god.
Yeah, and people have invested a huge amount of their lives in other theories. So, you know, if you come along and say something like that, it's attacked. I would have loved it if they'd engaged with the ideas, but they didn't
engage
with the style. And they were right about the style. You know, I wrote it in a racy style. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah, okay. I love that. I mean, discourse comes from putting things in the world which are not traditional, because somehow I've learned, at least in my own life, when you follow the same track as everybody else, they create a professional distance and aloofness to, like, knowledge. So by being a bit racy, you're actually giving an opportunity for a dialogue that otherwise might not happen.
We did it deliberately. I don't regret it, because the whole thing, you know, really was we want to present a different narrative, because the traditional narrative is so obviously wrong. Nah. So how do we do that? Well, you know, if we'd done it in academia, it would have just stayed there and gone around in circles, because, you know, especially in the theology departments, I mean, it's so conservative. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, you know, being on radio stations with some of these top academics, I mean, just like hysterical. I mean,
I sat with a Jesuit priest, by the way, about, I guess, 2 years ago, that was very high up in terms of doctrine. And what I came away with was, first of all, an hour of time I'll never get back in my life. And additional to that was this intertwined of beliefs. And that's what fascinated me so much, is that if Jesus wasn't concepted immaculately, then the implications for that decision have rippling effects on five other areas of doctrine.
Absolutely.
So what I learned in this exercise was that any one piece, it was almost like a computer program. If you change one bit of code, that has repercussions for all the other.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the big things that really is, you know, if you change, it's the way it's built is in Catholic Christianity, at least, which is what most forms have adopted, whether they're Protestant or otherwise, is, you know, you take away Adam and Eve, which everyone has, then if there was no fall and there was no original sin, what is he dying to put right? Yeah. So you've got, you know, the whole thing starts to, but when you're dealing with people who've given their whole lives to build, holding this up,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of crazy. Anyway, there's lots of stories with that. But the key thing is, I think probably to get into the ideas, because they're more interesting.
Yeah, of course. But thank you for starting there, because that was really a curious one for at least us when we had the discussion.
Yeah, it is interesting, especially since I'm not Christian and I didn't grow up in that environment. It's to me, you know, Bible is a very nice storybook. And I imagine whoever wrote it, they didn't think about all the gaps and the holes in the story. So some of things are just didn't make sense. But I think that's the whole idea of a belief, is that you don't need to make sense of it. It's not supposed to make sense logically.
I think that's really true of a story.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I mean, because essentially what the book is exploring, first, you know, there's obviously a lot, but if I condense it right down, what it's going is, first of all, there is no evidence for an historical man. There's none. Certainly not of coming back from the dead or any of that, but for anything, there's just no evidence. So that's one thing. Secondly, you've got in early Christianity two distinct groups, one that will become the church in Rome and then all of the churches that come from them, which is all of them.
Yeah.
And they're the people who create the Bible and that book of, you know, four gospels. And then on the other side, you've got what get known as Gnostics. They're very various groups. And they are the dominant group. And they don't believe that Jesus came in the flesh.
As an
allegorical myth. Mm-hmm. And that we have, they literally had hundreds and hundreds of gospels, of which these four are just, and it's not just a story of the father and the son, it's also a story of the mother and the daughter, which was cut out. So you get and since we found a whole library of these, well, not I didn't find it, but they were found in the 50s in Agbadi in Egypt, we've now got so many of these other Gnostic gospels, and then you get, Christianity is not at all what we think. When you then go back into the pagan world in which it's arising, and you find stories which are essentially telling the same story in different ways, with all of the motifs that you'll find in the Jesus story. So a virgin birth, born in a cave or a stable, son of God, 12 disciples, love, dying and resurrecting. These are all common themes.
Mm-hmm.
So then you stand back and you go, oh, it looks like a myth, doesn't it? You know, guy comes, turns water into wine, comes back from the dead. Maybe that's what it is. And in a way, what we're saying, I don't think, is any more controversial than if I came on and went, hey, do you know the story in the Bible that Jesus is meant to have told about the Good Samaritan? There was no Good Samaritan. It was just a story. And everyone would go, yeah, of course, it's a teaching story.
Yeah.
That's the point. And then you just go, that's what the whole book is. The whole thing, teaching story. Mm. That's the point.
Yeah.
But I think what is interesting also what you just said, Tim, about things that were taken out of the story. You mentioned about mother and daughter.
Yeah.
I cannot remember anything about that in the Christianity stories or books. And I would think that's, you know, we can get a lot of wisdom from that.
You know, so the whole relationship with women is very interesting, because the earliest Christians look to me to have been Pythagoreans. So they're Jews and Pythagoreans at the same time. So they're Jewish pagans. So they're creating something from the immense pagan culture around them, and they're mixing it up with their own heritage, just like everyone did. Excuse me, I don't want that to ring.
You can get it.
No.
Share it with us.
That is a, do you know who that is?
Oh, it's Peter Gandhi. Nice. Pick up and bring him on the show.
Hi, Peter. I'm just doing a podcast online right now, and we're just talking about the Jesus mystery. So I thought I'd take the call. Are you ready? What's the question?
How is it to work with Tim?
How is it to work with Tim Freak? Hang on, I'm going to put you on speakerphone.
How is it to work with Tim Freak?
Yes.
Yes.
He's rigorous. He's absolutely rigorous, but he's brilliant at what he does.
What's his worst trait?
What's my worst trait?
What's your worst?
There's too many of them. He's got lost.
I was going to say.
There's too many to choose from.
I'm here. What's your worst trait?
Yeah.
That's very difficult. Something that might be bad in a creative process might be considered bad in some other context, like being absolutely dogged about going for something and not flexible at all because you're absolutely convinced that that is the best way. That is a good quality, even though it might be a bad trait.
Mm. Good answer, mate. I'll
put on your point
when I see you for sure.
I like that answer.
I'll ring you back in a short while.
Yeah, give me a call when you've got a bit of time.
All righty.
I love his answer, by the way, because for a few reasons. First of all, it's a completely British answer. So for that, like, kudos. You know, when you ask any Brit to criticize another Briton, you're never going to get a direct answer. But that's already a big, it was closer than, and beautifully stated.
Yeah.
When you're doggered and you have an idea, you don't compromise on the idea, and that is it always the same. What makes us strong is also can be our Achilles heel at times. Wow. Yeah.
So there you go. You got both of us for a few minutes.
How did you feel about, like,
that hasn't happened for a long time.
Oh, really? Oh, that's beautiful. Is there any, in that quality I just spoke to you, is there how would you say that quality has defined you in your life? So the doggedness, the knowing this is the way to go, even if others around you don't necessarily agree.
Yeah, I think it's very it's around specific things. When I have a particular focus, especially around what I'm creating something, it's that I think that Pete's talking about, where I have a real drive to follow it through and to find the best and not to settle for something which isn't good enough. And the reason I think the Jesus Mysteries is such a good book is in part that Peter was very, very, very good at research.
Mm.
And I was very, very good at spotting what could be wrong. So I would look through the whole thing and go, we can't be right because of this.
Got it.
And then, so you need to go and look at this because this shows we're wrong. And then you come back and be like, oh my God, we're right.
That's incredible. Wow.
And then it would build over years of, right,
that's beautiful. Yeah.
Okay, this is coming together.
I think you'll make a very good detective.
Yeah, it sounds that way.
It was, this in particular, was absolutely a detective thing. You know, for instance, thinking, hang on a second, we know that the earliest letters, the earliest documents that we have are the letters of Paul. Mm-hmm. And he famously attacks the Gnostics. So how can the Gnostics be the earliest group of Christians, for instance? And surely Paul must talk about Jesus. And then going back into it and doing the research and finding a beautiful book called The Gnostic Paul by Elaine Pagels, who's the authority on this, basically showing that's not true, that he was a Gnostic himself. And he is the great hero. And it just completely endorsed the theory that we were developing, but we only found it by doubting our own ideas a lot. And that's my role, is to go, look, you know.
Yeah, you're good at doubting your ideas, actually, right?
Too good sometimes, and
yeah, it was funny because I watched your video, and in some ways I was surprised because when you said Andy, I've always, you didn't say it to Andy. That's the way I felt, because you speak so personally. Was that basically that the way you framed the world that you saw to that moment was very much in the Eastern philosophy of everything I experience is inside of me. And in a weird way, I don't know if I experienced you so much that way. I know the first time we talked, I was kind of in a nihilist period in my life because I just finished the book tour and I was kind of exhausted. I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't latch onto purpose. I think I told you at that time, the one thing I took away from the journey was that I didn't necessarily make life as having a purpose. And that was something that was a hard pill to swallow. What if there was just no purpose, and I allowed that to make peace with that? And what I thought was interesting when I saw what you had said was that in my mind, it was almost saying that, Andy, I took my thoughts way too seriously, like without saying it that way. And in some ways, I at least from my experience with you, I never saw you as taking your thoughts all that seriously. So for you to do a mea culpa on the thing also kind of surprised me.
So I don't think I was saying I took them too, I mean, I think, well, actually, I don't think I took them too seriously, but no. I do take them seriously.
Yeah, okay.
And I have a constant relationship between mystery, not knowing, and finding the best understanding I can find.
Yeah.
And I'd already, by the time I made the video, I'd moved away from that view for quite some time. It's just that I had actually seen that a fundamental argument for it, which is relied on by me and countless others in this area, was so obviously wrong, and that it had taken me, you know, at least two decades of using it before I'd gone, oh, that's not right, is it? And that was shocking.
And I have a weird question for you on that, because what you're saying is something that I almost say everything that comes out of my mouth is bullshit. I just don't know why it's bullshit yet. Honestly, I mean, I don't say that to be fun. It's like it's a story. It's a construct. It's a construct that suits the narrative that I'm in. But there's always a bit of, yeah, and I could probably tomorrow see that this is actually just, if I flipped the prism a little bit and looked at a different angle, it would totally be nonsensical.
Yeah, and that's been my life, really. And I'd say that as you speak to me today, I'm right in the middle of that. Uh-huh. Even deeper stuff of going, ooh, you know, is that so? And I think that's the great, you know, if you want to grow or evolve, then the price is you have to be an idiot, because you constantly look at yourself and go, oh, I was an idiot. So I've kind of got used to that, but it's still a bit shocking. And then I think there's the other side. You know, I've developed this thing I call paralogical thinking, seeing an opposite. So the other side of that is, yeah, but still do your best, Tim, to come up with the best understanding at any one time, knowing that it will be superseded and that, you know, it's always provisional and there will be more.
Yeah.
But I'm still looking for the best. I don't give up or just go, oh, well, this will do. I'm looking for the deepest thing I can find.
I always sort of say, like, everything in my life is a working assumption until it proves otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
And I think not to have that functioning, call it modus operandi, immediately creates a tension in your life, because you attach to whatever it is you think it should or shouldn't be, and then it creates its own mess.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting.
I think that's, I mean, I'm a great devotee of doubt. I think it's a lovely, wonderful, freeing thing to be able to hold up things and wonder about them and not just, you know, assume them. And I think it's hard. I think it's quite, I mean, I certainly find, I'm just in my 60s now. I just started off and I feel like, wow, there's things in my life, my personal life, that I'm able to question now. It's taken me that long. That's incredible. Yeah. Things about who I've been and what I've done. And it's kind of embarrassing. You know,
what would be an embarrassing thing for you? What would you say, wow, that's an embarrassing thing?
What just happens to come into mind is so many, but things where I look back, say on things I did as a young person that I've kind of dined out on, with like how outrageous I was and the amazing things I did, which now as an old person, I'd look back and I just think, you know, I ran away to a friary at the age of 15 after a big row with my dad, you know, romantic story, joined the friary for a while. Yeah. But only recently have I thought, I never rang my parents and told them where I was, did I? I just left them. And now as a parent, you just think, well, I know what they were feeling. They were thinking, oh my God, what's happened? And they were probably having an argument, I suspect, because I wasn't there and all of that. And so with energy, I can, you know, and it's just, so it's not just like I was young once, I can accept that. It's also, oh, I was young once, but also I took me so long to really see the wholeness of that situation, just being a romantic story about how I ran away to a friary, for instance.
Mm. Yeah.
So there is wisdom that does come with age, I guess.
I think a lot of it can. Yeah. I mean, you can get entrenched, like Andy said. Where you just sort of solidify, but if you keep moving, then you just, you know, you've been around the block so many times, you can kind of.
I think there's something that what I've noticed is that. the big I, the identity, right? What we attach to is a self-reflected idea of ourselves. So I've noticed that in age, I can look at other identities far more detached, which means it's still a story about that identity, but it also means that there's no attachment to saying he was an idiot. But the closer you are to that identity, the harder it is to say. Yeah. That's right. He was an idiot.
How you just behaved in the morning with your wife, it's much harder to say.
Yeah, of course. but give me another 2 weeks.
It's like, oh, I was an idiot.
Exactly.
Which is why what most people do is they tell stories about how foolish they were in the past, enables them actually to be wise now. So, yes, that is definitely right.
Yeah. I've got other questions, and I'm just before we segue, because I wanted to move into the individual. Am I saying it right now?
That's it. Simple as that.
Individual.
And when I read it, there was a kind of an interest. I had a mix of things. I read it. In some ways, I said, duh. Like isn't this obvious where we're going? Like it felt like that. But then again, I had to reflect back and like, it isn't that obvious. If I look at the 80s, the 90s, right? Like, these discussions, the psychedelics, you know, we just did a show on psychedelics, having these discussions openly and having it reflected on as sort of like something that isn't stigmatized and, you know, people talking about being one with everything and having that experience. It's less of this idea of, okay, these are just the hokey people in the corner that wear tie-dyes and smoke weed. and there's sort of a beautiful kind of coming together. And, you know, I've noticed in my own circles, everyone is sort of trying to create their own little movements. Like it's like the next government, the next education, the next this. And when I read, you know, because I printed it out as well, and I'm going to read it just quickly. Yeah. An astonishing leap forward in the history of humanity is quietly gaining momentum. Never before have so many of us felt compassion for people we've never met who are suffering in distant lands. More and more of us care deeply about other species and the natural world. An ever-increasing number are awakening to a profound sense of oneness with everything, everyone and everything. And then it says, pioneer, you're pioneering this sort of way to design our evolution from separate individuals into connected individuals who experience a unity that transcends our individuality. So, and then it goes on from there. Yeah. But so, and for me, sort of this sense of being one with everything is sort of Eastern philosophy in my own kind of wording of it. And what is it that makes you call this and say, there's an emergence of this now, unlike you've seen before? So what are the qualities you're pointing at when you write something like
this? So what I'm trying to do at this particular juncture, because of the way my life has been. So I've written all these books, like I said, on the different spiritual traditions of the world, partly showing, oh, they're all the same. They're all about waking up. There's this oneness mm-hmm. that people experience and love, and they're all completely different.
Yeah.
And there's an evolution happening. So my own journey has taken me is, oh, we need to a new spirituality because we're in new times.
Mm-hmm.
And that spirituality needs to be trans-scientific and needs to embrace science and add something to it. And most of spirituality is pre-scientific. It's still mythic in its quality. And some of it is definitely not rational, or it's not able to think about itself, doubt itself. So mm-hmm. having been around spirituality since I was a teenager, I just want to give it the most enormous kick up the ass. That's the honest truth.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs a new way of understanding it, which doesn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. It keeps the powerful essence. So that's what I'm attempting with individualism, to attempt to articulate something. I gave it a name simply so it could exist.
Okay.
So it could be something people say, I like it or I don't like it, because it just needed to have an identity.
Yeah. So someone would say, hey, if you've experienced Buddhism, then Buddhism leads you to that experience. So how would you distinguish from something that and what you're saying here?
Yeah. So one of the key ideas there is in the very, why I chose the name, is the idea of an individual who's conscious of unity. So mm-hmm. most of the great wisdom traditions, which I admire immensely, I now think are wrong. And it's simply because of they're the shoulders who I'm standing on, but it's wrong. Because what it does is they have a basic underlying, even when people don't see it, they have a metaphor of the fall. So you've fallen into illusion, you've fallen into separateness. God's had a dream and got lost in it, or the soul has fallen from the above. And now you have to get out. So what Buddhism is essentially about is getting rid of your humanity, get rid of your attachments, get rid of your thoughts, don't think, don't feel, don't just be detached. And you will eventually never have to come back to this shithole ever again when you die, because you won't. That's the essence of what's going on in all of Gnostic traditions too. Whereas what I'm wanting to say is actually our understanding's moved on. We now have this incredible understanding of the universe, not as a thing, but as a process. It's an evolutionary 14-billion-year-old process, and we're at the end of it. And it's evolved from hydrogen to you and me being able to think thoughts and express all of this. So spirituality is really the thing that spirituality is studying, is the end of that evolutionary process. And it, and what that does is it takes the individual and goes, the individual's not the problem. The individual's not something to eradicate. It's not just an ego that's in the way, which is nearly all of what Eastern philosophy says.
Yeah.
It's actually the foundation from which we wake up to something greater than ourselves. So the universe can wake up to being the universe, but through us as the individuals, not by denying our individuality. And that's probably the key central thing, that this period of individualism has been a stepping stone and a good thing, which can now lead us to something greater, which is through our individualism, through our individuality, to recognize, actually, of course, I'm the whole thing. How could I not be? I'm the whole thing in relationship to itself.
Interesting. Somehow, I still haven't got my finger on it, because I don't quite, I'm trying to see the distinction you're bringing in.
So, okay. So first of all, it celebrates the individual, not denigrates the individual.
Okay.
It embraces an evolutionary picture, so it takes what science has done, which is tell us we've had 14 billion years of evolution. It goes, okay, great. So it doesn't start with God or start with something and we fall from it.
Okay.
It goes, the underlying premise of the philosophy is to say, can we understand everything which has existence as part of this evolutionary process? So let's look at the simplest quality you can imagine. When I look around and go, well, what's the quality everything has? Well, it's the quality of being. Everything exists. It's kind of obvious. So can we take the simplest quality as of being in a process of becoming, of taking on ever greater qualities? So that
slow down a second. You said something just beautiful. Can I take the position of being and evolve it into becoming?
Yeah, that it is evolving. That being is becoming everything, and that process has led us from quantum possibilities and a universe which is just hydrogen, 10 billion years of forming the physical universe, 4 billion years of forming the life, but the end point of that has led to psyche, which is this experience we're having of a non-material domain of ideas, of imaginal information. Well, that's what spirituality is interested in. What is that realm of imaginal information? Now, so what science does is it cuts it off at biology. Because it leads to biology, and after that, there's a side effect of biology.
Yeah.
What spirituality does is it goes, oh, it's all really the imaginal realms, and this is a kind of a fall from it. So what I'm trying to do is we could have a new view here. If we marry these two together, they both need to change. Science needs to go, evolution doesn't stop with biology.
Yeah.
There's a whole nother realm after it, which is the one you can explore with psychedelics and with mystical experiences and with meditation, all that stuff. And then spirituality, stop seeing it as a fall. Actually allow the possibility that it's actually a movement towards the greater. So I would even take that further, and I would go take the concept of something of God or the transcendent being that quality that is not where it starts, it's where it's going. The universe is flowering into a being of conscious oneness. That's what it's flowering. It's not where it came from. It came from the simplest thing you can imagine, just being, and it's evolving into the most emergent. So it turns spirituality on its head. In that way, it keeps the essence of it, but it goes, no, let's flip this so that it has an evolutionary.
There's an aspect too, where when you bring them the words like emergence, and that what I said, being to becoming.
Yeah.
I'm having to twist my brain a little bit because you know how it works is at first you want to use your own structures and I'm like, I'm avoiding that because I can always pull back to that at some later point. So now I'm just trying to feel into what that might feel like if I just originally brought it into my head.
So what I mean by that is when I look at each moment, I see each moment. I mean, this is a really obvious thing, but I like that. The each moment is the realization of a new possibility that's never happened before. And each moment builds on the moment before it. So the hypothesis I'm trying to see if I can make work is that what reality is? Is what existence is the realization of a new possibility based on what's happened before? And has that been going on for our particular universe for 14 billion years? And each moment has led to the next moment. And then each moment contains everything that's happened before implicitly within it.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't be this moment otherwise.
Yeah.
And then you've got the ever more complex, ever richer universe. And what the universe is doing in that is the buildup of information is forming what we would call probably today algorithms, what scientists have traditionally called laws of nature, which is an old metaphor because there's no lawmaker.
Yeah. They're
habits or algorithms of nature, which are governing everything through this unfolding of ever more. And that's happening right now. And it's always happening because that's the nature of reality. Reality is the realization of potentiality in ever more emergent ways, where emergent just means it's based on what's already happened.
Yeah. So that's, while my brain is trying to make sense of I'm thinking that it relies on the consistency of time.
Yes.
Because the one thing that kind of came to my mind while listening to you was also about the thinking or the thought whether things are random or whether they are actually whether there's any causality. So, you know, things that happened in the past, to what extent do they actually determine what happens now? Is it really, is there a causal effect or is it simply things are just random, you know, what we're experiencing right now? We can be here because of what happened in the past or not, because, you know, obviously we only have one lifetime and we do not have a simulation of life to see, you know, the likelihood.
I think what's interesting for me with that is that it feels like that these, what Rupert Sheldrake and philosophers like that have called the habits of nature, the way that they form these habits or the algorithms or is that they evolve themselves. It's because in this view of what reality is, everything is evolving. So there's a creativity built into the very nature of reality because each moment is a new thing. And then the ability for that to be creative depends on what it's working with. So if you look at the way that atoms behave or something, then we can predict that pretty accurately. It's pretty deterministic. Because in the first period of evolution, atoms came into existence and went out of existence within seconds. They couldn't form. And then they did it so many times, they could form. A bit like once you said individual five or six times, you'll be able to say it forever. Because it's like you have that now. Yeah. Same. Yeah. It's learning. The universe is learning how to be things, how to do things. But the creativity then moves on.
Yeah,
so there's another level, which is a whole new level of creativity. And then it reaches this level we're experiencing, which is the psyche. And what I see is, the lower levels are pretty habitual. This is going to fall. This is going to fall. I have no idea what you're going to say next. That's a really creative level where it's not at all like that. And so I think it's always this mixture of the two.
There was something that you said a moment ago, which as you were describing the individual, that it took me, and this is what I do when I listen to someone, I don't really listen. On one level, I feel where I can connect to the experience, and then I see what is that experience giving me and how is it informing how I see the world.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I, as I was experiencing you, I felt high. And what I felt was, and I attached to the words being and becoming, I'm like, wow, you know, the whole show, A Wonderful Chaos, is very much grounded in that whole idea that people come on. In general, you're the most pieces of paper I've ever printed before a show. So this is a very well prepared show. Yeah. Never have I printed two pages. Maybe I took notes on one, but this is two. So, and the reason being, to some degree, if I am not listening to what you're saying and then basing whatever I say next on that, then I'm not listening to you anyway. So what is this? Is this like a totally disconnected? Right. Yeah. And so there was a quality to what you said, and I do want to touch on that because it's not that I have it completely clear, because it's the experience I had of it, not the logical, yeah, was that I felt in the being to becoming, there was far less ability for story to arise, which is how I tend to live anyways, meaning the story of the past is just the remnants of whatever was, but it isn't anything doing in this being in the moment. It could be, but it isn't necessarily.
It could be. It is, I would say, but
yeah,
not,
it is.
But it's fluid.
That's what I said, but it's not.
It's not. It's like, I mean, what I would say more, I would say that reality, I'm going to say it just blank. I would say that reality has evolved from hydrogen into a story.
Okay. Yes.
I think that's what's happened. I really do. I think the nature of the information that forms reality has gone from very, very primitive bits of information to this experience we're having of narrative, of story. Now, the problem we then have is we can get stuck in a story. And that's the problem we discussed earlier, where you get walled into a version of who you are or what life is, and that's disastrous. Yeah. But if you have an open-ended story, if you have an evolving story, that's where you're constantly questioning and learning and feeling and moving forward. But you are a story. The first thing you did when you introduced me, you told a bit of my story, you told a bit of our story, your story, how it felt in your story. We're stories.
Oh,
we're some stories. And that's so for me, it's like, wow, that's incredible. So it's a crass metaphor in some ways, but it feels like, you know, like looking at a computer game or something, where on the base level, it's just ones and zeros, but on the top level, it's a whole adventure. And that feels like what I'm in. I'm in the story.
And you know what I realized, I think it was like last week. I don't know if I was talking to you about it or who, but someone says, what do you do for work? And every time they answer, it's a different answer, because I really have to think about it, like, what do I really do? And it doesn't feel like there's a constant, right? There's a label. You could call it a life coach, a corporate this, or I don't know what. But Ronnie hated it. She would never take me to her events because she says, Andy, I can't take you to a financial event when you don't behave. And behaving is just saying what you do and not acting like that's something like that is intangible, right?
Well, comply to the social structure.
Comply to social structures, yes. So she got two nights with me a year that we'd go to these events. That was, and I had to be on good behavior. But the now I've even lost my point. So this is how it works in my head. I'm so not worried about
it. It was amusing, though. Right now, I'm very conscious of the fact that you've chosen this picture of a monkey looking over your shoulders, and it just feels beautifully sort of resonant the way that. And maybe that's another thing I'm feeling is that. What I love about this evolutionary picture is it connects me with everything. Another big thing it does, you know, the difference, is, and it's profound for me. Now, I have a group in Japan that I talk to, and talking to them just the other day, it felt like I really wanted to say, look, what this spiritual story that they had been involved in, like many of us, was that it's all an illusion. You're an illusion. It's an illusion.
Yeah.
Free yourself from the illusion. And I was here going, no, this is real.
Yeah.
It really is. That's the miracle. The world exists. That's the miracle. And you are real and you matter. And you could see there were people crying. And I thought, wow. I said, how did we ever end up in spirituality to the point where a guy from England has to come on and go, hey, you're real and so's the world. And everyone's like, oh, God, thank you for telling me that. I mean, that's
I think everyone saw The Matrix when he held up the spoon and said, this is only in your brain. You know, I mean, really? That moment
And it's lovely and it's fun, but actually the real miracle is that we are enmeshed in this, the being of everything, in the monkey, the table, the air, and that we exist and our individuality is so precious. Yeah. So that's the big difference, really.
Yeah, and I think it's very beautiful in the sense that the concept of learning within this individual thinking, right? Because everything is learning. So it's not just us human beings learning, but things evolve as they try to figure out their next reality or their next level. And that is how we expand somehow, mm-hmm. and we don't know to how far we expand, because yeah, I think it's really beautiful. And the fact that it takes material being or beings, less real things, it also makes you appreciate them, because they were there following their own path, their own evolution to where they are now, and who knows how they will evolve in the future.
Yeah,
you know, well, a table is just a table, but in the future it might evolve into something that is even more important in our lives. I don't know. So yeah, I think it's really beautiful.
I really, I love hearing you articulate that, because it's very much that the vision that, look, everything is evolving because the nature of existence is to emerge. That's its nature. And you get this lovely thing, like you mentioned purpose, Andy. It's like, then what occurs to me when I look at that, and people say, well, does existence have a purpose then? And my feeling is it doesn't have one. It's built into what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the realization of ever greater potentialities. That's what it is. So I am that. So if I have a purpose, it's to realize ever greater potentialities that are unique to Tim.
Or not. And then that would be your purpose, actually, right?
Yeah. That's what's happening here. And then you come back to the things we talked about earlier about, okay, so if I just get stuck in one place and I can't question my story, then that's much harder to happen.
Yeah, I think
it's much more likely I'll just repeat things.
I was going to say, and interestingly, when we get into that point of purpose, I think what I was speaking to was probably a far more rudimentary level of purpose than what you're speaking to.
Right.
Because I mean, I got caught in this trap of my life has to have purpose.
Right.
As opposed to life is purpose. And I see that was this, I dropped everything. I left Ronnie here, drove 3 months to America, did 60 sessions over a 3 month period, and just really just exhausted myself, all with this idea that I was going to have a purposeful life. Not really seeing the cost of this could end up in divorce, health issues, and everything, you know? So that was a little bit. So I love how you're articulating purpose is potentiality. Because in a way, if you look at it as in terms of potentiality, it's a more holistic idea. It's not pulling people into, let me sell you a purposeful life, which is what I've seen happen so much.
It's the complete opposite of that. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's going, look, it's creative. And what is it? It's like, for me, it's not like there's somebody up there who knows, Tim, you should be doing this. It's like, I have to make that up.
It might be
the opposite of what I think now. It's like when I look at what I do, like as a philosopher, it just through people like me, the universe goes, what am I? Am I any good? Am I going anywhere? And then through other people, it's asking different things, or it wants to just be sitting there in the moment, or it wants to, and you can see this kind of unfolding of all these different strands where each one of us is some unique. Well, literally, aren't we? We're literally a unique perspective on the universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's a definition of what we are.
I see, like, the further I've developed, I see some themes that have crystallized more in time. Uh-huh. And, like, one of those themes certainly is paradox. Like, I see that as being in paradox, holding two opposing apparently paradoxical views simultaneously and not getting stuck in either one. Like, that's something that I've seen, a harness of creativity. We have another guest on, Bob Deutsch, who's coming on, who sent me a document, which is also very much filled with very similar content. And I do believe that people, as they evolve, there is a point which might even be a limited belief, of course, right? Because it's just another story. But I do see that that's something that I've been very aware of in myself, of these competing views that are both held and at the same time not attached to.
So the biggest theme of my work up to Soul Story, my last book, is that. So the theme of most of what I've done previously has been what I call this paralogical thinking, which is thinking in opposites, both and rather than either or. And around the spirituality, that's when I was going, look, it's not one. We're not one or separate. We're both.
Yeah.
We're both of those. And you can see it from both perspectives at the same time. And so for me, it's like, it's not about accepting contradiction, because contradiction is seeing it in contradictory ways from the same perspective. It's more like seeing how, so for instance, an example would be, yesterday morning I saw the sunrise. So that's true, as it happens. But I could also say it's not true because the sun doesn't rise, does it?
We're on, yeah.
The earth goes around the sun. And yeah. They're both true. And if you understand the fullness of the experience, you can go, no, I see how they're both true. And there's no yeah. contradiction there.
Yeah.
They're just both true. And that's yeah. so in the same way I can see that everything is one, and yet also you're unique and individual, and so am I. And they're both true. And I can see how those two things are true at the same mm-hmm. time. And I love that. Yeah. I think it's true. And it stops this monological thinking where it's like you can only see it from this one place. And you
well,
see
I would
that
say it's the koan, right? The one hand clapping. For me, yeah. it doesn't allow my brain to rest. And funny, when Ronnie and I, we don't get in arguments all that often, but there's some times when we'll sort of have this frustration where it's like Ronnie needs she has a very determined brain. She needs the understanding of the outcome. And I'm often in the wonder. So I'll sit there and sort of have these wondrous thoughts. And then before the wonder, like even comes halfway out, it's like, but bum, 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 bum. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because what I'll find is that I don't exclude that part of my brain, but I also see that one part needs to live mm-hmm. and then the other part needs to complement or vice versa. Right. Yeah. It depends on where you're dominant, of course.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think that complementarity is absolutely key.
Yeah.
And applies to everything. I mean, you see it so much in politics and in the way people make choices. Something, you know, how often do you switch on the TV and it's like, no, it's bad, it's good. No, it's bad. No, it's yeah. good. And it's like, well, clearly it's both.
Yes.
So how do you understand that? And that's
yeah, I mean, I spent a chapter in the new book coming out, which felt a little bit hard to write.
Okay.
Which was, I wasn't going to take a side in politics because the foundation of it is based on competition and no one's seeking understanding.
Uh-huh.
And I said, each side will say I'm part of the problem because I'm not taking their side.
That's right.
And that way of interacting in the world is of so no interest to me anymore
yep.
because I see, what do I get out of it? All I get is I have to either defend something that I don't even believe in, or because there's no like academic, I don't want to use the word academic, but there's no reflection on the individual's thinking. It's always the thought has already been accepted. So if there's no reflection, it's just a competition of ideas.
Yes. I would love to see a world in which we got people who are in just, you know, terrible disagreement to express each other's ideas. You know, I'd love to get together the Palestinian representative and the Israeli representative.
Oh, yes.
You've been hearing each other speak now for decades. Yeah. Why don't you tell me what they're saying and you tell me what they're saying and just have that opposite reflection.
That's what I do in my coaching, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all the time. Like I'll say, okay, he's not talking, but let me tell you what he's thinking. And then I'll speak it out in the meeting. Of course, there's enough trust that people give me the space. But when those words come out of my mouth, there's times when I'm like, oh my God, I just said that. Like sometimes it'll be like, I don't really give a shit what you're like, that's what I'll say to the, you know, like the person will explain themselves. I'll say, I don't really even give a shit what you're saying. Can you just get it done? That's what he's saying, but he's not, you know, it's what he's thinking, but he can't say it. And the fact that he said that, it's almost like they look at you like, I know you said it, but it's so inappropriate. And yet it's so honest that everyone kind of laughs and says, if that's true, then how do we reconcile this? And I believe it's that inability to separate ourselves from the idea that we're under attack and that everyone needs to win, that we're not willing to embrace that actually we are just human and we have these crazy thoughts and there's no reason we shouldn't actually embrace them and then get to know one another.
Would you say that the key then is that we stop making each other feel like we're under attack?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say the whole thing is like, I'll be on like, you know, I don't talk a lot when we're not on the show with somebody who doesn't have a question. Cause I just think to myself, what am I don't have anything I need to win. I don't care if you understand what point is required. So the thing I'll always ask to begin with is there really a question here? You know, I'll do it lightly. It's not condescending or trying to put anyone down, but what's your real, I tend to, cause I'm kind of emotionally connected. I'll already hear what the judgment is. So I'll just say, hey, you know, this is what I'm feeling. Hmm. Yesterday, Ronnie and I had one of those discussions.
Remind me?
I
remember.
You were angry at me. You were really pissed. And then in the end, we got much closer through it.
Yeah.
It was basically, I don't even remember what started it. It was,
I said, if you don't like hearing what I have to say, then don't ask me.
Yeah. And what was it? What did I ask you? Oh, I read you something. Oh, I read her a letter I wrote.
Yeah.
And then her response was an unequivocal, this is wrong, without any reflection on, oh, this is how it made me feel, and this might happen to somebody else. So by doing it, it was putting me in a position that, do I have to defend what I've written? No, actually, it helps me if you tell me, hey, Andy, I'm confused when you have these four things that you've written, as opposed to, no, that's just wrong.
Yeah.
And so I was into the point, like, I was like, babe, I understand that that's how you give the feedback, but do you realize you've now forced me into a position to either defend it or just say, hey, you're right, or just say, good, thank you for the feedback, goodbye, you know, without any just connection, which I want to be in connection if I can with the people I'm with, you know. So it was nice.
Yeah, that made me think, how many people have I alienated by acting the way I have acted in life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. That's what I mean about getting, you know, when I said about getting old, it feels like I'm doing a lot of that.
And I'm very conscious of words in terms of, you give a lot of consciousness to the meaning on a much higher level, and I give it on a much lower level. Like, oh, these words trigger this reaction in general.
Uh-huh.
If dad was abusive, right? So I live with like constant verbal abuse as a kid. So as a kid, I got a very acute sense of what triggers, you know, micro expressions, like just from being living in fear and being a little bit more empathetic as a child. So as I got older, it was like, oh, wow, now I can see through all of these things that don't appear to be obvious to others, but they're damn obvious to me. And what I dealt with it is, I made jokes all the time. That's how I coped. I just told jokes because I needed to alleviate this sort of obvious tension in my system. But hey, if this is the only way to cope, then hey, I'm just going to make fun of you till you have to acknowledge or not that this is what's going on. And in my adulthood, of course, I saw that was only a coping mechanism. And then I sort of saw, oh, in this trigger, it. And then you always know there's something you don't see, of course, that's usually dark and attached to a mother or father, you know, and then you go there, you know, but you go there if you handle it lightly with love, right? As opposed to trying to push someone somewhere. That's what I found, at least. And then it gets back to the point I missed earlier when I segued, is when someone asked me what I did and I lost track a few minutes ago, is I realized that when they look at life through a prism, and that prism tends to be with some sort of fear, anxiety, hate. Yeah. I take the same thing they've said and I run it through my body, my system, which is really filtered through the heart. And I will reframe the same thing they've said or stated as a story through whatever the heart translation of that would be.
Mm.
And that's what I've seen more recently. Like, I just realized, oh yeah, that's all I do, is I reframe things from the heart.
Mm.
You know, your dad was a total you reframed it when you talked about your childhood, right?
Yeah.
Because you said, in retrospect, if I reframe it through the filter of love, they didn't know what the hell you were doing. So I think in some ways, as we evolve, we can take the filter of love and see how things are so much clearer than through the filter of whatever the past stories are that don't really, you know.
Exactly right. Yeah, I had I think there was a moment in this process last week or the week before where I'd often thought this life review that people talk about in near-death experiences, where you see the whole of your life from a deep perspective. I thought, wow, that sounds amazing. And then just recently, it's just felt like, oh God. Oh, dear me, that's going to be.
Oh, beautiful. Oh. Thank you. By the way, we've gone over our hour, if I see correctly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great being with you. I knew it would be great to be with you.
It's been great fun.
We're going to be in Somerset in the end of August. So if we can always have a COVID distance hello to one another. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
So love you, my friend. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you. A real delight to be with you. Nice to have Peter with us for a few moments as well.
Exactly.
That's a nice surprise.
Peter Gandhi with a Y, not an I.
All right, I'll end with this story then. Sure.
Yeah, please.
I've known Peter since we were very young. We woke up together. You know, we took our first LSD trips together, everything together. And when we were at college in this little tiny town down the road where we both were born, I would want to do things which were like, see things in other ways. So they just built this huge green roundabout right near the college. And I looked at it and said, that's a roundabout, but it could be a camping site, couldn't it? And of course, once I said it, we had to turn it into a camping site. So we camped the night around a bit with our girlfriends and woke up in the morning with the police. What the hell's going on here? And said, right, what's your name? To which I said, Tim Freak. And he said, what's your name? It's Peter Gandy. He said, yeah, and I'm PC Mickey Mouse.
Oh, I love it.
We ended up together. All right. I love you very much. Thank you so much for being on your show. And it's truly a wonderful chaos.
Yeah. Thank you. It was great being with you. Bye. Bye. Well, that was fun.
Oh, interesting.
Thank you for joining me.
Yeah. Thank you for taking me on board.
Yeah. Bambos's job might be at risk. He's got to get back healthy before you prove you're like able to take over his chair.
No, I'm very happy to be a just spectator because I learned a lot, actually.
Oh, and that's nice. So thank you for being with us on A Wonderful Chaos. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful chaos. We like it that